Thanks for listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Andrea Lorien, one of the producers on the show, and what you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening, and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Today, the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, announced that forever chemicals, or PFAS, have to be removed from tap water. It's a landmark move by the federal government. These chemicals are linked to cancer and other health problems. But utilities say it's going to cost them an enormous amount of money to comply. And those costs might trickle down to taxpayers. Today on the show, we're going to learn about efforts in the state to regulate PFAS. We'll also hone in later in the show on a rather ambitious climate superfund proposal from state lawmakers. Their plan is to make big fossil fuel companies pay up for climate change. First, we're joined by Vermont Public's climate and environment reporter, Abigail Giles. She's been following all this legislation closely. Abigail, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michaela.
Yeah, and we are glad to have all our listeners out there as well. So, Abigail, let's start with this big news from the EPA. And we should really start with what PFAS are and how they affect our bodies and the environment.
Yeah, Michaela. So PFAS are these tiny, they're sometimes called forever chemicals. They're manufactured and they've been around since the 1940s. But really what makes them so notable is that they take a very long time, sometimes, you know, an indefinite amount of time to break down in the natural environment. So they tend to kind of accumulate. And as you had mentioned, they have been linked to some pretty alarming health impacts. And essentially, last year, the EPA actually came out and said that virtually no level of exposure to these chemicals is safe for humans. The challenge is, you know, they are used for waterproofing, fire retardant. So they are really in most of our manufactured and consumer goods. So now, I think at the federal level and at the state level, governments are really trying to figure out what to do about this.
Wow. And the federal government has kind of come down on the side of we need to regulate these now. What did the EPA just announce?
Yeah. So essentially, I should say Vermont is one of, I think, about 20 states in the country that do have their own regulations already in place for drinking water. Broadly speaking, Vermont regulates five of these chemicals. There are thousands of them, but we limit them to about 20 parts per trillion in aggregate in drinking water. Essentially, the EPA came out and has what appears to be an even stricter standard, really restricting some of those to, you know, a fifth of what Vermont requires now. And they're also including some chemicals that are sort of like the companies have made them to sort of replace PFAS as they sort of anticipate that these chemicals are going to be, you know, phased out. So reporting still underway on this, but, I think that there's some real questions here about what this means for Vermont. And I reached out to the DEC this morning, the Department of Environmental Conservation. They said, you know, they're still digging through this rule to try to understand what this means for our state.
And they'll have to look at, you know, how it could affect utilities, the landfill here, other big entities like that.
Yeah. And, you know, I think Vermont has had work underway, you know, that looking at a surface water standard. So we're talking here just about drinking water. This rule does not regulate, for example, PFAS in lakes and ponds and rivers or in soil or anything like that. It's really just pretty narrow. I think in terms of who this would affect, you know, it's really our drinking water systems. And, questions certainly to be raised about sort of what investments Vermont has made so far, whether we'll need to make more. There's quite a bit of federal money attached to this announcement as well. But I think, as you had alluded to earlier, there are questions about how much this will cost nationwide. I think we just don't know yet.
Yeah. Well, there is some legislation making its way through the State House right now that relates to PFAS. Right? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So pivoting a little bit from drinking water, really one of the big issues around PFAS is this problem. You know, we've got we are putting these chemicals into our water everywhere. They're in the goods that we consume. They're in the things that we wash ourselves with and our makeup and, you know, things we throw in the trash. They're in clothing. And so in Vermont, there's been a real push, which we've seen nationwide, to try to sort of restrict these chemicals in the goods that we consume and also really focus on personal care products. So the things that we, you know, use on our bodies every day. And this bill, it's called S-25. It goes to the House floor this afternoon, actually. It would restrict these chemicals in menstrual products, in makeup, in all kinds of personal care products, but also in artificial turf and in clothing, which is huge. The version of the bill that is in the House now actually got strengthened from an earlier version of the bill. And advocates are saying, because this includes cookware and also childcare products, that this could be one of the strongest pieces of protective legislation like this in the country if it advances.
Wow. And listeners might remember that a similar piece of legislation cropped up last year. It passed the Senate, but didn't quite make it to the House. What's different about this year?
Yeah, so it enjoyed tripartisan support. I think it was actually a unanimous vote on the Senate floor last year. And they just kind of ran out of time. So this session, it's the second half of the biennium. They are looking to move this. Essentially, this bill goes further than what we saw last year, in part because several other states have already strengthened their restrictions. And so the changes, you know, the addition of cookware in the ban and then also child care products, those reflect moves by other bigger states in the U.S. since last year. So we're really seeing states try to sort of get ahead of this problem.
Well, Abigail, I know you're going to be diving in this afternoon to learn more about the EPA's ruling, its effects on Vermont. By the time that this show is rebroadcast, you might know even more. But let's switch gears for a moment and look at legislation affecting flood safety in Vermont. Flooding's been front and center, of course, this legislative session. Tell us more about the Flood Safety Act.
Yeah, so the Flood Safety Act is sort of the biggest bill this year that lawmakers are weighing to kind of plan for the next climate disaster Vermont might face. We know that human-caused climate change is bringing more extreme rain to the state, potentially exacerbating flooding, and this is really an effort to try to sort of plan ahead, make communities more resilient, and it really focuses on development, Michaela. So one of the big provisions of the bill is that it would create statewide regulations on new development in river corridors. Those are the places where the river kind of moves outside of its banks. Right now, the state kind of leaves that to towns. We don't have a really robust system for sort of, you know, unilaterally restricting new development in these places where buildings can get swept away. And so that's one of the kind of key provisions here. It also includes new protections for wetlands. And in addition to that, bolsters support for this private dams in the state. So really takes a look at kind of how can we manage from like the watershed scale to try to make Vermont communities less vulnerable to flooding in the future.
And I imagine these efforts intersect with parallel efforts, well, we can intersect with parallel efforts, you know what I mean, in the legislature to reform Vermont's Land Use Law Act 250 in order to build more housing.
Right? Yeah, you know, I think this bill really kind of says, okay, we know there are places where we see damage to structures over and over again. We know that these are areas where floods, they continue to, you know, displace people. Maybe we should stop developing there. And there's another piece of this too, Michaela, which is that rivers, if you allow rivers to move in places where, you know, there's undeveloped land, it can kind of slow their course when we have a big flood event that might impact a village, for example, a really developed area. And so I think there's a lot of interest in protecting the places along rivers that are not developed right now and kind of looking at ways to kind of incentivize density in our historic village centers. Now, there is a problem because those places are flood prone. So I think in the State House, we are seeing some really interesting conversations unfold about, you know, what do we do in places where we have historic development that may also be impacted by flooding? And how do we balance those kinds of needs.
Mm. And tell us again where the Flood Safety Act stands in the whole legislative process.
Yeah, so it's in the House. It's in the House Energy and Environment Committee. And they're taking testimony on it this week. So it looks like it's kind of moving along.
And when we talked a few weeks ago, right in the middle of the legislative session, you told us about a renewable energy bill that was leading to some pretty heated debate in Montpelier. It would make Vermont utilities source all of their power from renewables by 2035, and some utilities would have to do it even sooner than that. The big question here, of course, is how much is this going to cost, and if those costs are going to get passed down to consumers. Any updates on this bill?
You know, that bill, it made it from the House to the Senate. It is in the Senate Natural Resources and Energy Committee. They've been pretty tied up with work around Act 250 in a big conservation bill. So we haven't seen that get taken up yet, but I anticipate that we'll probably hear more soon.
All right. And then, Abigail, let's turn to the meat and potatoes of today's Vermont edition, which is the Climate Superfund bill. So this bill essentially would force fossil fuel companies to pay for some of the damage that their products have caused in terms of climate change. Can you tell us a little bit more detail?
Yeah, so this bill essentially, it's modeled after the federal Superfund program. So at the federal level, we've long had a program in our country where manufacturers of chemicals, companies that produce toxic waste in the environment, essentially are required to clean that up. The rule really says you made this, you profited. You didn't, there's no, you know, whether you knew or you willfully caused wrong is kind of irrelevant, but you've got to clean it up.
And you break it, you buy it.
Very much so, Michaela, yes. And so this bill essentially endeavors to say, well, we know that climate change is costing, you know, our country millions, billions of dollars every year already. You know, New York State actually recently tallied what they expect climate change and adapting to climate change will cost by 2050. And it was, you know, to the order of $150 billion. So that's a lot for a state. And essentially, you know, Vermont is endeavoring to say we're a small state. We know this is going to cost us a lot to adapt to a changing climate. We want to require big oil companies to essentially pay for a fair share of what their products cost our state. So that's kind of the sort of meat and potatoes of it.
And figuring out what that fair share is, I imagine, is rather complicated. How would lawmakers or scientists figure out which companies are responsible and for how much?
Yeah, so essentially this bill focuses on the biggest companies in the world that refine and extract fossil fuels. So we're not talking to clarify about, for example, like a small fuel dealer. We're talking about the big companies. And essentially those Vermont would the Agency of Natural Resources would compile an account of sort of, you know, what Vermont wants and needs to do to adapt to climate change. The state treasurer's office would tally how much climate change and climate adaptation has cost, is going to cost Vermont. And companies would be required to pay a share of that figure based on how much their products contributed to global warming, global climate change during, you know, the last couple of decades, essentially. And what's really interesting here, I think, Michaela, from a science perspective, is that this bill leans on this idea of attribution science, which is essentially a sort of field in climate science that is kind of emerging, growing, and essentially it's this ability to say, you know, this natural disaster was X amount worse because of human-caused climate change. In Vermont, we see a lot of flooding and extreme rain, and interestingly, scientists are increasingly saying we can do this sort of math for those kinds of events. So I think this is a case where you're seeing Vermont be on the cutting edge. Massachusetts, California, New York have similar legislation, but we don't have this at the federal level. And we're sort of, you know, one of the first small states to say we think that these companies should pay their fair share this way.
And what kind of support is it getting from lawmakers? And does that support fall along party lines?
You know, it's been really interesting. The bill in the Senate actually sought tripartisan support. There were a few Republican lawmakers, mostly from the Northeast Kingdom, who voted against the policy. But very interestingly, you know, several Republicans voted in favor of it. I think one of the big unknowns here is that the federal Superfund program, you know, there are some challenges there. These are big companies that won't part with their money easily. So Vermont will not recover these costs without legal battles. and there have been some on all sides of the aisle who've said, you know, we have concerns about what that will cost our state. So I think that was where you saw some hesitation. The bill in the Senate that advanced, ultimately, I think, won some additional support through a provision that would require the state auditor take a regular look at how much those legal fights are costing the state. And I think it'll be really interesting to see what happens in the House. The governor has said he still has concerns about the timeline and state agencies' capacity to do this work right now. So I think, you know, remains to be seen whether it earns his support later in the session.
Have you heard anything from fossil fuel companies about their potential response? Are they already weighing in?
Yes, we reached out to their National Industries Association, and essentially, you know, they condemned the legislation and argued that it would, you know, slow efforts to, you know, transition away from fossil fuels in their industry. But they didn't provide evidence to support that claim. So they are very much opposed to legislation of this sort.
Well, a lot to keep following there. And Abigail Giles, our climate and environment reporter, is on it. Thank you so much, Abigail, for your time.
Thanks for having me, Michaela.
Joining us now is one of the co-sponsors of the Climate Superfund Act, Senator Dick Sears. He's a Democrat from Bennington. Senator, welcome.
Thank you, Michaela.
Why did you introduce this bill?
Well, after talking with various individuals, particularly those in the natural resources field and others, and my background in terms of dealing with chemicals in the water supply in Bennington, many people's wells were polluted. I decided to be a lead sponsor of this bill. I thought it was important. I've also worked on other bills in the past, dealing with strict liability for polluters, as well as dealing with medical monitoring for companies that pollute and then cause problems for individuals who then have to pay to monitor their medical condition to make sure they don't have some form of cancer or whatever.
You mentioned well pollution. In the early 2000s, ChemFab left North Bennington for Merrimack, New Hampshire, and it was later discovered in 2016 that the manufacturing plant had been leaking forever chemicals into drinking water. How did that experience affect your views on holding these big companies responsible for harm they cause?
It tremendously affected my views. The cost to extend the water supply to those wells that were polluted by Chemical Fabric Corporation were in the millions. And for a small town like Bennington, maybe one of the larger towns in Vermont, but it's certainly small in comparison to other areas of the nation, was astronomical. And the amount eventually settled on was $48 million. And so somebody was going to pay that $48 million. Would it be the taxpayers? Would it be the people whose water supplies have been contaminated by Chemical Fabrics Corporation, which was bought out by Saint-Gobain? a multinational corporation? Should it be the state taxpayers, the federal? And ultimately, through a lot of good negotiation between two administrations, the Scott administration as well as the Shumlin administration, Saint-Gobain agreed to the $48 million payout. And we've now, in Bennington and North Bennington, covered most of the homeowners who discovered wells that were contaminated. The problem is, once the settlement was reached, we now find other areas of our community where wells are testing above the federal limit.
Well,
and state limit.
On that note, Senator, we got an email from Seth in South Burlington who asks, why don't the companies that use PFAS in their manufacturing processes bear the cost of cleaning them up? You're saying here sometimes they do.
Well, they did because of negotiation. We had lawsuits going against them. They didn't do it willingly.
And that's,
the state of Vermont, through the Attorney General's Office and the Agency of Natural Resources, are the ones who carried on most of the negotiations with Saint-Gobain. And then there was a private suit against them for the medical monitoring and other things for folks that lived in the area. What was declared by the Agency of Natural Resources in Bennington and North Bennington as an area of contamination.
Well,
and so there was a settlement reached on that as well.
Well, we're
through that was a Judge Crawford's federal decision.
We're speaking with Senator Dick Sears about the Climate Superfund Act, which is making its way through the legislature this session. Let's go to the phones. We have a call from Rick in Burlington. Rick, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm all in favor of this. I think it's a simple matter of justice. The fossil fuel companies have been really irresponsible in dealing with this issue. And I think that they should be paying for it. The cost is just incredible, and it's not something that should be just passed off onto the taxpayers.
Thanks, Rick, for weighing in. Senator Sears, are you hearing from your constituents about this? Do they have similar opinions to Rick, or is it pretty split right now?
Well, I think it's fairly more like Rick from most people in my area of the state, because they've been through this with, as we just discussed, with Saint-Gobain. But it's important to know that we've come in the bill, we combined what was the governor and treasurer's climate resiliency effort into this, so that we can take a good measurement of what the cost will be to the state of Vermont to repair the damages, and as well as change our situations to better combat future flood events and future storm events. So, for example, we're looking at what is costing right now to recover from both Tropical Storm Irene, what that cost, and what it cost to recover from the July and December flooding, particularly in Barrie Montpelier. And I look at the cost to the state just to recover and the homeowners and et cetera in Barrie, Montpelier, Londonderry, wherever you want to look at it, for the small businesses, what it's costing them to recover. It seems to me that the principle should be that the polluter pays. The person who caused the problem should pay. I don't know any other area where the victim pays the cost. And in this case, the victim would be the small business, perhaps the homeowner on the river, or even the state of Vermont through its infrastructure, ends up paying the cost of the damage done by the polluter.
Well, if you have thoughts on the Climate Superfund Act, call in at 800-639-2211. We have Thomas calling in now from New York. Thomas, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm calling because the largest contributor to greenhouse gases is large agriculture, not the transportation sector. So I don't see how any bill that punishes ExxonMobil is going to have any effect on that at all, and it's not even dealing with the largest problem.
Thomas, thanks for weighing in. Senator Sears, what are your thoughts there?
Well, man, we're looking at the 68 companies worldwide that would reach our emissions level of to be impacted by this bill. So my response is that we know that the carbon pollution from these oil refineries and oil manufacturers is huge. I don't know the statistic of the farms, and that I'm not going to dispute that because I don't know.
And Senator,
I heard no testimony on that.
As I understand it, this Climate Superfund Act targets, as you said, major multinational companies, not small fuel companies in Vermont, and small-scale farmers in the state.
That's one of the reasons I have a problem with the term Superfund, because the Superfund covered everybody who, you know, from the small garbage hauler who hauled something to the landfill to the huge corporation that also put stuff in the landfill, and then the landfill becomes a Superfund site. And this is very different. This is only focused on the major, large contributors.
Lawmakers and Governor Scott have voiced concerns over the fact that if this bill becomes law, it would essentially be the first of its kind in the nation. They say that, you know, Vermont shouldn't be the first. We should wait, learn from the experiences of other states, particularly larger states. Why do you disagree? Why should Vermont be first?
Well, I think Vermont should be first. I don't care if we're first. I don't mind being first in this case, however, because I think that we will set an example for others, and they will soon follow suit. Other states will soon follow suit who are having the same problems as Vermont, whether it be Florida, New York, California, New Mexico, wherever. And I think other states will soon follow on. My experience in Bennington and North Bennington dealing with Saint-Gobain taught me a lot about taking on big multinational corporations. Our state is well positioned. We have a dedicated attorney general who's in support of the bill. As someone mentioned earlier, we have the auditor taking a look at the cost to the state for the litigation that will surely happen. But at the same time, if somebody doesn't start it, I don't think it happens. So I think we can be a good first. And I look back to 2000 when Vermont became the first state to pass something akin to civil unions. And a lot of people said, oh, we shouldn't do this. We shouldn't be the first. And the Supreme Court forced the legislature's hand, no question about it. But I look now at how marriage equality has grown, not only in the nation, but worldwide. And thinking about little Vermont back only 24 years ago.
Well, I also want to add here a quick note on our last caller's statements about agriculture and transportation's impacts on climate change. According to the EPA, there are estimates of total greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. by economic sector. Transportation contributed about 28% of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. in 2021. Agriculture contributed about 10% there.
Yeah.
800-639-2211 is our number. Let's take one more call before we have to take a quick break. Steve is with us now. Steve, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, I'm all for taking on the big corporations and what they may have done to contribute to global warming. But in Vermont, and the senator knows this, I think, the single biggest source of CO2 pollution is the McNeil wood burning plant in Burlington. It produces over 400,000 tons of CO2 a year. There's something you could take on. And I don't know why that's ignored. They say it's renewable because it burns wood, but It's not renewable in yours or my lifetime. So maybe they should think about looking at that also. It's there. It's clearly in their jurisdiction.
Steve, thank you for your call. I do want to ask the senator about this before we have to take a break. Is the McNeil power plant on your radar, Senator?
Not at this time, but I certainly think it could be. The first thing, my priority right now is to deal with this, as you just pointed out, the major contributor nationwide and worldwide to the global warming impact is from the carbon groups, particularly the big oil. And it's not to punish anybody, by the way. This is to recoup the cost of their pollution. And it's based upon a pretty simple legal policy of the polluter pays.
The McNeil
I think if McNeil is polluting, then McNeil should be paying. But we haven't. I mean, that's not part of this bill. This bill is focused major on the carbon majors in the world, not just in Vermont.
The McNeil Generating Station is, for listeners who aren't familiar, an electric utility company in Burlington. And we spoke recently with the new mayor, Emma Mulvaney-Stanek, who said that she is very interested in looking closely at McNeil, seeing whether it should continue as it functions right now.
That's good. I couldn't be further away from McNeil and being in the state of Vermont.
That's true, so down in Bennington
I'm
there.
I'm not too familiar with McNeil plan, actually.
We have one more guest joining us this hour. Jennifer Rushlow is the dean of the Maverick Lloyd School for the Environment at the Vermont Law and Graduate School. She recently testified before the Senate Committee and the House in support of the Climate Superfund. Jennifer, welcome. So tell us about the legal framework this bill is based on. The Superfund law has existed for decades, right?
Yes, the Superfund law, the federal Superfund law that pertains to hazardous waste spills and things like that has existed since 1980. And so that's really the framework we have for this kind of polluter pays principle, where if you pollute the environment, then you should be responsible for paying for it. And so that law sets up a superfund, a source of money for doing that, for paying for the cleanup of that pollution. And that's really the inspiration for the Climate Superfund bill.
Now, Jennifer, one of the big concerns that I have heard about this bill is that it's essentially setting Vermont up for a pretty costly David versus Goliath legal battle. These fossil fuel companies will almost certainly sue. Do you share that concern?
I think it's very likely Vermont will be sued. I am sort of the mindset that good governance requires lawmakers to move forward with good laws, despite the potential for litigation. There's always the potential for litigation. But certainly there is a litigation risk, and I'm sure the state will be sued. But I think the good news is that the state is on the right side of the law, and we have all reason to believe that they should prevail if they are sued.
And if they are sued, the Attorney General's office would be involved in defending the state. Senator Sears, have you spoken with Attorney General Charity Clark about this legislation? Does she support it?
Yes, we did, and she does.
Do you share any concerns that have been brought up here about this legal battle that could ensue?
Well, yeah, obviously we're concerned. That's one of the reasons language would put in for the auditor to keep an eye on the cost to the state pursuing. But I think other states will already have come into play once Vermont passes the law. So I think there will be more attorney generals around the country joining us. And it's important to note that those companies, we offered them time to testify on the bill, and they didn't want to give away their litigation strategy, so chose not to testify.
Jennifer, we were talking about the fact that if Vermont were to pass this Climate Superfund Act, it would essentially be the first of its kind in the country. From a legal perspective, what do you think of Vermont potentially being first in this space?
Well, I think that with lawsuits in general, it's very important who the parties are. And so in an instance like this, the state that goes first and may get sued, the facts of how that state is impacted by climate change will be really important to the success of the lawsuit. And I think Vermont is perfectly positioned to make the claim that we need a law like this because the members of the public in Vermont are paying for the consequences of climate change rather than the companies that are causing that pollution internalizing that cost themselves as a cost of doing business. And so I think that that's why there's, political will for a bill like this right now. And that's also exactly why Vermont is really well situated to be the state that goes first, because the impacts of climate change are visible right now in a very public way here.
Well, this bill has garnered support from all three parties represented there in Montpelier. Four Republican senators voted to pass it on to the House. Let's take a listen to Senator Richard Westman, a Republican from Cambridge who represents the Lamoille district, who voted for it.
When I look at Bennington and the PFOAs that were there, clearly the precedent is there for this. And you look at it and say, well, should we be on our own to pay for this? I don't think so.
Senator Sears, are you currently having conversations with folks on the other side of the aisle from you about the importance of this bill? What are those conversations like?
No, actual conversations are with the members of the House right now.
Mm-hmm. As we continue to consider this. Do you feel like your job here is done? It's made it through the Senate, and now it's on to the House. Do you have any role to play there as they consider?
Oh, yeah. I work with the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. We meet on a regular basis about a variety of bills, and this is certainly one of the most important ones for the Senate side, and I think he recognizes that. We'll continue our conversations.
Well, let's go back to the phones. We have John in Waterford on the line. John, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. These corporations that you're talking about, by law, they have a fiduciary responsibility to maximize shareholder value as part of, their incorporation. When you artificially raise their costs, they must just pass that on to the consumer. So I know it sounds good, like, oh, we're going to make the oil company pay, but you're not. You're simply going to pass that cost onto the consumer, and the poor people in Bennington, first they have a flood, and then they end up paying twice for it. So maybe the guests don't understand how corporations work or how, they do have to maximize shareholder value. They're not going to just eat that cost. They're going to pass it on to the consumers at the pump.
Right. Well, thank you, John, for your call. Jennifer, I'm wondering if you could provide some thoughts there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a valid concern. I think that what I would really dispute is the phrase artificially inflating the cost. I think what we've been doing to date is artificially deflating the cost. This is a cost of doing business, and it should be borne by the company. And how that gets passed on, I think ultimately then that becomes a matter of consumer behavior, and that is a choice. You kind of make it sound like consumers don't have the option of changing behavior in response to a change in price. I don't think that's always the case.
And Senator Sears.
Last week I was driving to Montpelier, filled up my gas tank. That was $3.29, I believe. This week it was $3.39. Nothing happened. It went up 10 cents. No taxes were changed. Nothing happened that would change that. The oil companies daily increase the cost of oil or decrease it, depending upon, and the producer down in the down in Bennington or wherever the gas station is sets a price, and et cetera. So I don't buy this that they're going to artificially raise the price. I don't, you know, they will do what they always do, and that is try to work on supply and demand. And if the demand goes down, in other words, not as many people are using fossil fuels, particularly gasoline to drive, more people are using electric cars, et cetera, then the price will go down. I don't, you know, it's not like they're going to set out and say, well, today I'm going to raise the price because Vermont passes this bill. We will see.
Jennifer, I'm curious if you think there could be any sort of parallel action at the federal level, or is this going to be something that, you know, if states want to pursue a climate superfund, they're going to need to do it themselves?
Well, could the federal government take an action like this? Sure. Will they? Probably not anytime soon. I think we have seen almost total inaction from the legislature, from Congress, which is the branch of government that would need to act for a law like this to come into play at the federal level. You know, certainly the executive branch is hustling. We've seen the release of many different new environmental rules in the last few days. But ultimately, for a Superfund law like this to exist, it would have to come from Congress, and there does not seem to be anything near the political will to do something that significant.
And I believe that the Vermont bill was in part inspired by a proposal back from in 2021 by a group of U.S. senators, including our own Senator Bernie Sanders. That bill didn't advance, but it spawned several of these state-level climate superfund measures. Senator Dick Sears, have you either spoken with Senator Sanders about this or kept an eye on what's happening at the federal level?
I have not spoken with either Senator Sanders, Representative Ballin, or Senator Welch about it, no.
Well, Senator Sears, one thing we have talked about briefly in this conversation is the flooding that your part of your district experienced this past summer, and kind of the larger repercussions of that flooding on attitudes towards bills such as this one. Go ahead.
I think it changes that attitude. I think it changes the attitude dramatically. The more we see of the need for climate resilience, the more we see for need for changes. And the more I realize, and my constituents realize, they can't do it on their own. They need help from either the state, the feds, or from the polluter who actually caused the damage. And we've actually seen the results of climate resiliency when we made changes in, and I'm thinking about some of the changes that were made following, Hurricane Irene, and how those areas of the state that were changed withstood the flooding of last July. And they did much better than expected. For example, Route 107 between Bethel and Stockbridge saw a lot of damage during Irene. You couldn't get there from here. Now it withstood one small sinkhole following the July floods. Hmm.
Well, in the brief amount of time that we have left, Jennifer Rushlow with Vermont Law and Graduate School, if this bill does indeed become law, what role do you think that you, your students, the school might have in kind of assisting the state implement it?
Yeah, there's a lot of excitement over the prospect of this bill being passed, and actually a group of environmental law clinics from law schools submitted a letter of support saying that they would be pleased to provide support for the state's efforts in defending the bill should they be sued. So assistance with legal research and just providing support to the litigators. So our students are incredibly hungry and passionate for these issues. And I think the state would find that they have a lot of allies in defending a law like this.
Jennifer Rushlow is the dean of the Maverick Lloyd School for the Environment at Vermont Law and Graduate School. Jennifer, thank you so much for weighing in today.
Thank you. Thanks.
And Senator Dick Sears of Bennington, before we let you go, tell us one more time, what is the path forward for the Climate Superfund Act? What happens next?
Well, my big hope is that the House passes it similar to the Senate bill and builds on our work, and then that the governor will sign it. Last I knew, the Agency of Natural Resources was taking a rather neutral position on it, rather not opposing it, not necessarily supporting it. My hope is the governor will support it, and that we can move forward with the bill.
Senator Dick Sears, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you to everyone who weighed in on this topic. We got lots of calls and emails with all different sorts of opinions about a Climate Superfund Act, and we will look forward to continuing the conversation with you all.